Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From newsounds.org, this is the Soundcheck Podcast. It's our series of live in-studio performances, streaming live on Facebook. I'm John Schaefer. Jorma Kaukonen was a founding member of the band Jefferson Airplane, a band that he named and for which he wrote this song called Last Wall of the Castle. But Jorma has also had a long and enduring relationship with American blues and folk, as anyone who's heard his other band, Hot Tuna, can attest. He also is a great solo performer, and his latest project is a memoir. It's called Been So Long. It brings Jorma Kaukonen back to our WNYC studios here in Lower Manhattan for this edition of the Soundcheck Podcast, and he's going to start us off with one of his pieces called Sleep Song.
That is correct. And since we talked a little bit about guitars, I'm in drop D, the mother of alternative tunings.
Shoreline smaller every day. Wonder why we feel this way. Well, you don't know, I got nothing left to say. Cause we've been blown across the water like a ship ain't got no sail. That ain't no way to be. Feel that longing, loud and clear, dead end streets and alley here. Well, when you're flying, you got nothing left to fear, unless you're blown across the water like a ship. Got no sail, that ain't no way to be. Winter wind keeps blowing through the trees. But life keeps smiling gaily as you please. Silver birches lying by the road. Branches lined against the falling snow. Left the shelter
yesterday. Had to reach a place somewhere, and find it, I got nothing left to say, 'cause we've been blown across the water like a ship ain't got no sail. That ain't no way to be. Well, I've been blown across the water like a ship ain't got no sail. That ain't no way to be.
That's called Sleep Song, solo performance live in our studio from Jorma Kaukonen, author of the new book called Been So Long, his new memoir, which is out now. It's great to have you back. Most of the things that we've done together have been New Sounds live events uptown.
Correct.
But to have you here in the studio today. Travel is a recurring theme in your life and in the book.
Definitely.
And you might imagine that a life of touring would get tiring, but you write, even towards the end of the book, how much you love to travel.
Right. I guess it's a good thing. I mean, you know, when my daughter was younger and she was sort of looking to see Dad home more, and she asked if I could get more jobs around Ohio, I told her, you like those piano lessons? Do you like the horseback riding? And she gets the deal now. And of course, now that she's almost 13, she can do it without my presence some of the time. But yeah, I mean, I've traveled all my life. My dad was in the Foreign Service and he was in the military before that. And we just always did. And in a way, I've always felt comfortable with it.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of a childhood spent in far-flung places like Washington, D.C. and Manila.
You know, right.
It's like, and bringing with you, wherever you went, the sounds of what was, even back then, not fashionable music, you know?
True. When we started playing music, you know, you and I talked a little bit before we were potting away here. Washington, D.C. has been a great music town always. There's all kinds of stuff going on there. In the world that Jack and I circulated, it tended
That's
to
Jack
be...
That's Jack Cassidy.
That would be Jack Cassidy, yep. Yes, the same. It was sort of guitar-oriented music. However, at Woodrow Wilson High School, where I went, go Tigers, by the way, Woodrow Wilson, the guitar was a geeky instrument. The cool instruments were like sax, drums, piano, stuff like that. So the guitar was not an entree to the upper echelons of society at Woodrow Wilson. In Southeast D.C., it absolutely was. You know, a lot of the rockabilly stuff and whatnot were hits back then, but most of the guys that I knew, we were good enough to play it, you know. And Jack and I blundered into it, and we probably shouldn't have been playing in public, but we did.
Well, how punk of you, right?
Right, yes. We were way ahead of our time.
So, the book, of course, recounts, you know, almost a lifetime of playing music with Jack Cassidy in one form
Absolutely,
or another,
yeah.
And continuing these days with Hot Tuna. But, you know, there are surprises along the way. I mean, I was not familiar with the whole Filipino part of your life, going back to Manila as a college student. And speed skating. I was not aware that you were, at one point in your life, like seriously, deeply into speed skating.
That's right. I sacrificed a lot of good jobs to do that. Yeah, you know, it was, I guess it was 72, the Olympics then, and I remember Art Schenk, the Dutch skater, was a big medal winner that year, and Kees Verkerk. Anyway, I'd skated when I was a kid, and I really liked it, and my mother had me take figure skating lessons with Dick Button, great American figure skater.
Later broadcaster.
Absolutely. In any case, to make another long story somewhat shorter, I just wasn't into the ballet and all that kind of stuff, and I didn't skate for years. But that year, in 1972, I don't know, it looked great. We got into it. My ex-wife is from Sweden. We spent time there. I got to know the Swedish Olympic team at the time, and we actually got to train with some of the guys. Now, when you talk to people, they think that we were competitive. Listen, age-wise, we were so over the hill at that time. But all these people that we got to know in the speed skating world, then I think they thought we were cute or something, you know, and we were really serious about it for a while, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, and you were Jorma from Jefferson Airplane, you know, you're kind of at the height of your
right.
Fame.
We had just left the airplane. Yeah, that they thought we'd lost our minds. Maybe we had. I don't know.
But you know what? You know, at that part of the storytelling in the book, I'm thinking, wow, you know, he's gone through the 60s, and yeah, he's dabbled in LSD, but yeah. as you said, at one point, you could count the number of trips on a hand and a half.
Yeah, it wasn't really my thing.
Yeah.
You had to do it, of course, but yeah.
And so here you are, you know, you've gone through the 60s, you survived the 60s, and all that came with being a famous rock band at that time. And now you're into this, like, super athletic thing, and I'm thinking, wow, this guy has gotten really lucky.
Well, we weren't tripping on the ice, I can tell you that.
Yeah. But then the dark part, right. The descent, happens after that.
It did. And, you know, not everybody out of the 60s got into hard drugs, but for whatever reason, it seemed to be my path, and that was the deal. Yeah, that didn't really come until later. And, you know, looking back on it, I remember thinking, or rather not thinking, that any of that stuff would ever happen to me, but
yeah.
It did.
Yeah. Impossible to be a speed skater, a serious skater, a serious athlete of any kind.
Right.
And still, so something had to give.
Right.
And
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It was like a changing of the guard in terms of my environment.
Yeah.
And it went from a reasonably healthy environment to a somewhat darker one.
Have you ever gone back to speed skating?
Very, very briefly. My daughter, about 5 years ago, was skating. And I thought, you know, I blew a bunch of money. I got some speed skates, and I could still skate. But she turned to me and she said, "Dad, you're going to have to learn how to fall." And at that moment, because they were teaching the kids to fall,
right.
At that moment, it reminded me that falling is inherently a process of skating of any sort. And I figured at my age, I don't really need to be falling on the ice.
Okay. I think that was probably a wise move.
Probably. Probably.
So let me ask you, in view of all this, it is a memoir. You don't tout it as an autobiography,
right.
You know, one fact after another. It's a series of memories.
Yeah.
So how do you remember some of these things? I can't find a better way to phrase
that. That's interesting. And, you know, the memory process, of course, after I finished the book, some of my old friends resurfaced who, if I had known where they were, I would have interviewed them because they remembered a lot of stuff that I wanted to remember that I couldn't. It's just interesting, the stuff that sticks with you. And usually, you know, for me, the memory has something to do with evoking almost a visual memory in a place and time. And that's kind of where I went with that. Now, a lot of the stuff, there are little entries there from my blog over the last almost 20 years. And a lot of those things are out of time. But as I mentioned in the book, I'm a huge Kurt Vonnegut fan. So writing stuff out of time, I'm totally okay with that. Just as a quick aside, one of my buddies that I ride motorcycle with at home, he's a good guy, and he read the book, and he was really upset about the out-of-time stuff. And all I could say to him was, you read shop manuals for entertainment, so I understand why if it's not sequentially, it's going to upset you. So there's a lot of stuff that's out of time. But just in terms of remembering stuff, it was amazing to me when I got into the writing process, the things that surfaced. Because you don't go around thinking about this stuff all the time, but boom, all of a sudden there it is.
Right. Well, and also at various stretches of your life,
sure.
when you've been in an altered state of consciousness,
true.
Memory might not be what...
memory might be
was.
A loose concept.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's that too, of course.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jorma Kaukonen. One of the questions I had going into the book was, I wonder if he'll talk about what it was like to be a kid in America with a Finnish name that no one could pronounce. And of course, the answer is you weren't Jorma, you were Jerry.
For many years, yeah. In the America of today, having odd names is just the way it is. Nobody gives it a second thought anymore. However, in the 40s, it was a big deal. And my dad, when he was in the service, his nickname, and obviously his real name was Yorma also, because we both have the same name, but he picked the nickname Jerry. And I tell the story in the book, when he was at the Navy Language School in Ann Arbor in World War II, Mom came home to find some of the kids on the base hanging me because I was a Nazi spy because of the name. And it occurred to me at that time that maybe I'll take another nickname also. And I kept that, and I was Jerry for many years. When I moved down to Southeast Ohio almost 30 years ago, and again, this has changed in the last 30 years too, a male name ending in a vowel was upsetting to a lot of my neighbors. And so they just called me Norm.
Wow. That's okay. That's
what can you say? I know.
I'm speechless.
That's the way it is.
I want to come back to the ranch in a little bit.
Sure.
But, the book is called Been So Long, right. And you have, of course, a song by that name.
What a coincidence.
Different tuning from the sleep song, though.
Well, hopefully. I'm going to just take a quick look at this here.
Aside from the drop D of sleep song, you don't get too far into the weeds of alternate tunings and
No, you and I were talking about this. You're a guitar player. You know the deal. That's just not the... You got to dance with the one that brung in. That's not the one that brung me. I like G tuning, but I don't really play in it like some of my friends do.
Yeah.
I write songs in it. But if you think about it, really, I mean, this tuning here, it's just another tuning, but it's the one we all know.
Right.
And for all practical purposes, it's the only one I know.
All right. So you want to play Been So Long?
Sure. Been so long since I belonged here, ever since I lost my way. That was when I still had something special left for me to say well unto you, just to see your smile, laugh and look at me. Well, when you held me tight in the morning, child, now you know it's been so long since I felt at home in the mirror. Was a time I once came running down the street we used to live. That was when I still had something special left for me to give well unto you, just to see your smile, laugh and look at me. Well, when you held me tight in the morning, child, now you know it's been so long since I felt at home in the
That is Jorma, a.k.a. Norm, a.k.a. Jerry Kaukonen. And I know there are legions of people who say Kaukonen. I'll just say Finnish names always.
First
without
syllable.
Exception. Right. Stress on the first syllable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, before we move on with whatever incisive things you have to comment on, that little thing there on the original recording of this, which is a live recording, mm-hmm. I'll pull up, pull down. Jack does this weird thing that's actually a mistake, but it's so incredibly hip. It's like what Eric Clapton did when he turned the beat around in Crossroads. And he played it that way for years. And then somebody pointed out to him that they perceived it's just in an odd place, but it really works.
Yeah.
And now he does it quote unquote right. And I keep telling him, you got to listen to the recording. You got to go back. It's a great mistake.
Well, you know, it's so interesting you say, because the question I was just about to ask you was, how much do these songs change? Will it be just as you played it here? Will the ending be a little different?
No, I mean, I mess around with stuff all the time, you know. Sometimes it's conscious, and sometimes it's creatively different. But, you know, but the good news is that, and I really have to thank the folks that like us, our fans, that allow both me and Jack and myself personally to not sound the same every time. I mean, the song's the song. That's how it goes. Right. But do different things happen? You bet they do. Absolutely.
So Hot Tuna is still kicking.
Absolutely.
You and Jack will be back here in New York on November 21st.
Correct.
At the Beacon Theater.
Yep.
Which has become sort of a second home for you guys here.
Right,
in New
and
York.
It'll be live.
You mentioned the ranch, Fur Peace Ranch,
yes.
Moving into southeastern Ohio,
yes.
Like 30 years ago.
Yep.
That has been kind of a sea change for you, because while you still travel, you now have like a set
right.
place to call home.
Right.
And it's more than a home, though.
It is. I mean, first of all, I've never lived any place that long in my life. And that's my home. I'm a southeastern Ohio guy now. So I lucked into, in 89 or 90, I lucked into 126 beautiful acres, southeast Ohio. You know, Ohio's like New Jersey. It's a maligned state. You know, it's the I-95 corridor or the Cuyahoga River's burning, whatever. That was 40 years ago, you know. We have polluted rivers, everybody does, but it's better, okay? Anyway, southeast Ohio is a beautiful area. It's in the Appalachian foothills. And this little piece of property we have is very lovely. Anyway, when we moved there, and I lived in an adjacent farm for a while before we built the ranch, I was sitting around and my wife Vanessa and I had talked about maybe having a music school or something. The concept was beyond loose at that time. And we looked at each other and she goes, you know, and we'll call it the Fur Peace Ranch because it's a fur piece from anywhere. These days, anytime you have an idea for something, you start a website. In those days, you printed business cards and made T-shirts. So we had T-shirts and business cards. And then in 97, Vanessa went, you know, we're going to do this. And she was actually able to get a local bank to believe in us and lend us the money, which in itself is unbelievable. And we're into our 21st year. Anyway, Fur Peace Ranch, you know, we have an NPR radio show, or I guess it's a community radio station that's affiliated mm-hmm. with yeah. NPR, WOUB yep. out of Ohio University. We have a 250-seat venue. We have the ranch, of course. We have our Silodelic Gallery. We got a bunch of Marty Ballin stuff there. May he rest in peace. And stuff. And we're open pretty much from March to November. Not every weekend. I should know all this stuff. My wife would be slapping me still. I don't know.
It's all in the book, Jorma. Read the book.
Go to the website, www.furpeaceranch.com. Anyway, it's really cool, and we have a great time. And for us to love music, and you don't have to be a professional music person to feel this. You know, I'm lucky because I get to be one. But to be surrounded by like-minded spirits, to be able to geek out about the same stuff, what gauge strings you use, C6 9 flat 5, or whatever. We love that stuff.
Yeah. And for you, I mean, teaching is coming full circle.
Absolutely. Paul Kantner, also may he rest in peace. My friends, man, it's just leaving me behind. This is upsetting to me. Anyway.
Well, you have Grace Slick still around.
She we
did
do.
The forward
we do.
To the book, and Jack wrote the
That's right.
afterward to the book.
Right. So. Me, Grace, and Jack. Anyway, I met Paul early on. And he was teaching at the Benner Music Company on Stevens Creek Road. And, you know, I was playing a lot, but we weren't making any money playing. And he went, you ought to try teaching. And I remember saying, well, what am I going to teach? He goes, how about what you know? And, wow, what a concept. And so I started teaching, and I continued to teach through almost the first year the airplane was together. And those first months the airplane was together, when I was commuting to San Jose to teach, I made a lot more money teaching than I did with the band, I can tell you.
Yeah. And just briefly, Jefferson Airplane was your nom de blues.
Yes, we all had nom de blues. Steve Richmond Talbot gave me that nom de blues. Steve Mann was Lil Son Goldfarb. And Tom Hobson was Blind Outrage. I mean, we never use it. Nobody ever was it was just a goof. And it was one of those things that I remember, just as a gag, when we were talking about names for the band, I remember saying, you want something really silly and stupid? How about Jefferson Airplane? And they went, wow, that's a great idea. It is?
From the beginning, when you were teaching, would you be teaching things like Gary Davis songs? And
sure. I remember the... So that's a sort of loose version of Blind Blake's West Coast Blues. It was one of the first things that I learned. Now, you got to remember that in 1962... I'd only been finger picking for 2 years, but I spent a lot of time at it, and I had a good right hand. In any case, I didn't know anything about tab, and even though I knew about piano traditional notation, I didn't know about guitar traditional notation, and I kind of figured out my own tab version. And
for folks who are not guitarists, a tab is simply, it's like almost like a drawing of
where. It's a little roadmap. Yeah. You know, it's limited in a lot of ways, but anything that helps people get it.
Yeah.
In any case, and so I started teaching, and of course that was the beginning of the beginning of the big folk scare, you know, transiting into the big rock and roll scare. And there were a lot of people that took lessons from me and Paul. And as a matter of fact, I remember, I wish I could remember this gal's name. There's a gal that was probably my daughter's age, 12 or 13. There was the president of the local Beach Boys fan club, who for some reason took guitar lessons from me for like a year.
Wow.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
But you have come back to the music of Reverend Gary Davis, also known as Blind Gary Davis, for 60 years, it seems like. I mean, I'm a huge fan too, but what is it about his music that...
I think there's a lot of things that really attracted me to the Reverend. You know, when I was at Antioch College, which is when I met Ian Buchanan, who wasn't one of the Rev's students, but they were friends, and so he'd learned a lot of the stuff. They were colleagues. John Hammond was there that year that I was learning this too, and John at the time brought the tapes that we know now as the two Robert Johnson albums that he got from John Hammond Sr., his dad. And I remember listening to this stuff, and we loved them, of course, because it's Robert Johnson, for God's sakes, you know. But I thought I'd never get this, and I didn't. John did, obviously. The Reverend's playing, the way his playing was organized in a more, for lack of a better word, classical kind of way, it made sense to me. Now, the Reverend, as you know, is a very, very complex player, and there's lots of contrapuntal stuff. And to really get into him on the level, the guys like David Bromberg, you know, or Woody Mann, or a lot of people that studied with him, Ernie Hawkins, that's deep stuff. Mm-hmm. And when I saw my friend Ian do that, I went immediately to the stuff that I could get and play as quickly as possible. And that worked out okay for me. But to get back to the Reverend himself, the music was so complete to listen to. And even when he did depressing songs, he was such a biophile himself. There was just a better day around the corner. I always felt that. So, and that life power that the Reverend had, I think, really caught me also.
He was from North Carolina originally, right?
Right. Have you read the book, Say No to the Devil?
I have not.
Oh, you got to get it.
Yeah,
great biography.
But he spent decades here in New York with a steady parade of people going to his door to study with him.
No, absolutely. Mm. I mean, his story is unbelievable, really, for a man of color of his time, a blind man. I mean, the roads that he travels, one can only imagine. and he wound up here. And Mother Davis, who lived to be quite an, I think she was in over 100 when she died. I'd have to look it up. I don't actually remember. But as a result of what he did, and lots of guys like me paying homage to him, you know, and recording his songs, that she wound up living in her own home. They had two homes for a while, actually.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable stuff. What a story.
Yeah. And what amazing music. As you said, Jorma, it could be dark, and it's rarely darker than in the song you've chosen to play for us today.
Right. Yeah, we talked about that. Death Don't Have No Mercy is one of my favorite Reverend Davis songs, and it's just one of these things I do all the time. And the funny thing about it, it's a dark song. But, you know, when I play a gig, especially in the tri-state area here, and I go, I'm going to do a song called Death Don't Have the Mercy, and the crowd goes wild, and all I can say is that's the spirit.
Now, you want to play it for us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Well, death don't have no mercy in this land. In this land, come to your house, won't stay long. Look around the room and your family will be gone. I said, death don't have no mercy in this land. Don't give your time to vacation in this land. Death don't never give you time to vacation in this land. In this land, come to your house, won't stay long. Around the room, near family, we'll be gone. You know, death don't have no mercy in this land. He gonna leave you standing and crying in this land. Death will leave you standing and crying in this land. In this land, you know, come to your house, won't stay long. Around the room, your family will be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. In this land, you know, come to your house, won't stay long. Look around the room, your family will be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land.
Jorma Kaukonen playing a song by the Reverend Gary Davis called Death Don't Have No Mercy. I asked you before, Jorma, whether your songs, whether they change night after night. That is a very different performance from the one that, for example, you played for us at a New Sounds Live concert we did some years ago.
It mutates. It mutates.
But he mutated it too.
Oh, absolutely. And we need to tell your listeners, you need to go to the source at some point. And I'm just going to put out there, there's a lot of Reverend Davis stuff out there, but the Rudy Van Gelder recordings on Prestige Bluesville are, I think, the masterful ones because he was still badass in that era, mm-hmm. and they're beautifully recorded. Harlem Street Singer, the version of Death Don't Have No Mercy on that, that's a good one. Anyway, I've just been doing a acoustic duo tour with Jack, and when I'm playing with Jack, I get to approach it more from a lead guitar player point of view because mm-hmm. I got a bass player with me. So I've been exploring a lot of other things, which I noticed since I've just been doing a gaggle of solo gigs, that I kind of throw in there also, you know, for better or worse. I mean, you know, when guys like me make a mistake, nobody dies. We got to take some chances, you know. Live music is not for the faint of heart.
Now, you know, talking about all this old music, one little surprise about halfway through the book is you quoting a phrase from Frank Ocean. So do you listen to a lot of contemporary pop music?
You know, I stumbled into the Frank Ocean thing because of that little quote that I use, which I really like a lot. And as a result, I listened to him, and it's really interesting stuff. There's good stuff out there. And I'm really lucky, too, because I have a 21-year-old son and an almost 13-year-old daughter, and they listen to all this stuff, and they turn me on to stuff, mm-hmm. This is a couple months ago, so she could be beyond that now. You know how that goes.
Yes.
But she... My daughter's really into Billie Eilish, you know, and I started listening to that, and she's really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good stuff.
All right. Well, there's a lot of good stuff out there.
There is.
There always has been, and it takes people like you to take a 70-year-old song like Death Don't Have No Mercy and keep it on the radio or whatever medium this is.
At least a 70-year-old song.
Jorma's book is called Been So Long. It's out now on St. Martin's Press, and he's been with us here on this edition of the Soundcheck podcast from newsounds.org. And Jorma, always great to see you. Thanks so much. Congratulations.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks a lot. This is Soundcheck.
Well, in this life I'm living in, I see the light. Sons are gone, now I know what is wrong and right. Well, morning came on slowly, pushing back the night. It's good time now, I can't see the light.
That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Check us out at newsounds.org for other performances, in-studio videos, gig alerts, weekly music roundups, and more. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. Our video producer is Justin Sergi. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.